This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talked to Brand Workers organizer, attorney Daniel Gross.
Daniel Gross is going to bring us amazing news about brand workers and a significant victory against a food processor who is exploiting immigrants, unlawful immigrants, and others.
We also speak with Center for Constitutional Rights legal director, attorney Bill Quigley, who's recently come back from Haiti.
1 million people still living in camps. Where is the U.S. and UN aid? And who's suffering the most? As usual in disasters, women and children.
Stay with us.
Heidi, congratulations. I'm holding in my hand this beautiful red and white and yellow pamphlet. You have the right to remain silent. Congratulations for getting this out. A Lawyers Guild pamphlet's going to come in very handy.
Thanks, Michael. It's actually a Know Your Rights guide for law enforcement encounters, and we designed it specifically so that it could fit in the rear pocket of someone's jeans or pants. It has basic Know Your Rights information, what to do if the FBI comes to your door, what if you're not a citizen. I think there's something about rights at airports, if you're under 18. It's free of charge at nlg.org, and if you want to get bulk amounts, we will send you up to 50 free of charge, and then we just ask for shipping and handling for orders above that.
It's interesting that it fits into your pocket because, you know, when Michael and I and you, well, I know you're not as old as us, but when we used to give advice to people at demonstrations, we used to tell them to sew their pockets up so you couldn't plant, the cops couldn't plant marijuana in their pockets. So you go to demonstrations with all your pockets sewn up, but at least they don't do that as much. So you can carry this little book with you instead of writing the whole thing on your arm.
Heidi's I'm laughing. Speechless.
You're speechless.
That's fascinating.
And about pockets is also interesting. My daughter once had to do a school assignment about clothes for boys or girls when she's a little girl.
Right.
And, of course, what you notice is that girls' clothes have no pockets.
I know. I hate that.
It's terrible. It's like
I know.
It's
I only buy things with pockets.
And it's a weird sexual discrimination. Boys are supposed to carry all these things, but girls, you know, they're
They have to have a pocketbook.
They have to have their purse or their pocketbook. Anyway, but back to the pocketing the guild pamphlet called.
You have the right to remain silent.
Now, Michael's going to say something about the substance.
And if you receive a subpoena, call the NLG National Office hotline at 888-NLG-ECOL. I'll repeat, 888-654-3265.
Or if the FBI starts to question you, don't answer even the first question. Just say, I don't want to speak to the FBI, or refer them to your lawyer, and that's H-E-I-D. No, no. But in any case, you should refer them to your lawyer, or just say you're not talking to the FBI. And it's such a short little pamphlet, it's perfect for taking to demos. It doesn't have our basic position about the FBI, which is once you start talking to the FBI or Homeland Security or any of these so-called law enforcement or police intelligence, there's the potato chip example. Once you start eating potato chips, you can't stop. It's the same for talking. Heidi's
Michael,
waving her hand.
That is a great point. And in fact, we do have a section called Standing Up for Free Speech. I just want to quote one sentence or two. Informed resistance to these tactics and steadfast defense of your and others' rights can bring positive results. Each person who takes a courageous stand makes future resistance to government oppression easier for all. Right. So just to remind listeners, if you'd like a copy or multiple copies, it's called You Have the Right to Remain Silent, a Know Your Rights Guide for Law Enforcement Encounters. And it's available through the National Lawyers Guild, www.nlg.org.
Michael Ratner, I see that you have the front page featured article in the International Socialist Review, the ISR, Obama's National Security State, an interview with Michael Ratner. How can our listeners get that?
Well, they can go to the ISR website, isreview.org. That's isreview.org. And the article is quite a lengthy question and answer between myself and the interviewer from ISR about where we are with Obama's national security state. And my conclusions, sadly, are awful, really. That is to say that we have incredible continuity between the Bush administration and the current administration, the Obama administration, on many of these issues. In fact, almost all of them. Guantanamo, preventive detention, rendition, secrecy, all the issues we've been covering here on Law and Disorder for a long time. And I really want to thank ISR for doing this thorough set of questions with me. I conclude by saying, really, there's no choice here but to continue to fight on. And what you can't do is look to the establishment, and I include Obama, to do our job. And I say that basically without any compromise, we must all remain on the side of right and justice. So I think it's, as you said, Michael, you liked it. And I think people will learn a lot, and particularly as people have these false hopes, these, what did my mother used to call it? We see those, that water that looked like, mirage on the road when it looked like water in the distance.
Yeah.
I remember as a little boy looking at mirage as well. I think you could say that Obama and his claim that he was going to do better on any of these issues is a mirage.
Well, Michael, headlines in the Times last week were that the British are going to do something by way of compensating the victims who were put in Guantanamo. Please give us an update on that.
Well, actually, it's amazing. The British government is going to settle claims made by 15 Guantanamo detainees who were sent to Guantanamo. Apparently, and I think this is well known, the British were involved in or knew about them being sent to Guantanamo, were there as interrogators, and British intelligence officers were oftentimes involved in interrogation. Some of these people were tortured quite badly. Many of them had lawsuits against the British government, and the British government was faced now in these lawsuits with an order to disclose about 50,000 of the documents. And I think rather than disclose the documents, they decided, let's settle these cases for quite a bit of money. We don't know exactly, but millions of pounds is the way it was talked about. One of the people still remains in Guantanamo. That person is named Shaker Amar. He's been there for 9 years. No real claim that he's a terrorist of any sort. And I suspect that he will be soon brought to England. I think this settlement is crucial for really people understanding how incredibly retrograde and antediluvian, which means before the flood, if I had to look it up, the United States is. Because here you have this case brought in England by 15 Guantanamo detainees. Some of them were my earliest clients or the center's earliest clients. Mozambique, for example, was one of the center's earliest clients. The Tipton Three were the three I interviewed in 2004 in England before we knew about the Rumsfeld torture, before we knew about Abu Ghraib, who talked to me about what happened to them, and I came away utterly shocked by the level of torture to which they'd been subjected. So here we are, 6 years later now, finally the Tipton Three, Mozambique, and the other Guantanamo people getting a financial settlement. Now, it's interesting because the leverage there was the court-ordered documents to be disclosed, and the government also. This is not the Labor Blair government. This is the conservative Cameron government. So think about that for a second. The Labor government, which actually, of course, participated in the torture, is now settled over their heads. In fact, Labor complained about these cases being settled. Now, what's interesting here in the United States, of course, is we've brought as many cases as the British have, many more, really, on behalf of our not U.S. citizens in particular, although there's some, but really on behalf of people around the world who have been tortured. And courts have dismissed every case. They've never ordered a document to be produced by the United States. And the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, has gone into court and said, state secret, dismiss these cases. So you compare that for a second to what the English are doing, and not that they're doing perfectly by any means, because they're one of the key people who was alleged to be involved in torture, and MI5, that's their secret CIA-type organization, is not going to be further investigated. There's still some criminal investigations going on, but there is also a so-called Blue Ribbon panel to investigate Britain's role in torture. We all remember when Bush said recently, or wrote in his book, that he authorized waterboarding, and he claimed it wasn't torture, et cetera. And, of course, the British came out again, the Cameron government, the conservative government, saying it's torture. There's no issue about it. So here you see our ally for a while with the so-called liberal government, Britain, really finally coming to some terms with what happened at Guantanamo.
Well, what Bush said, you were in Europe, Michael, but Bush was on TV, he was interviewed. He was asked about torture, and he said, I'm not sure it's torture, and I went and I got a legal opinion, and I was told by my lawyers that it's not torture, and therefore I did it because it saved American lives. And for Bush to say it wasn't torture is interesting because his attorney general came out and said at the beginning of his administration that waterboarding is torture. Of course, waterboarding has been torture under international law and American law for many years. And Bush is now saying that he got a legal opinion and therefore it's not torture and he could order it. What do you make of that?
Well, we should understand also that what happened to the British, the 15, most likely, I don't know every case, but was not waterboarding, but was other forms of torture. So here you have us focused on waterboarding, which is clear torture. Bush admitted a war crime, basically, by saying
getting permission from your lawyer isn't good enough. People were executed at Nuremberg for that.
Right, and it's particularly not good enough in Europe. Who knows what U.S. courts are going to do with this stuff. But certainly nothing is the most likely. There's no prosecution, nothing. So Bush openly admitted that he committed a war crime. And the 15 in England, they had all the other techniques, the isolation, cold temperatures, the beatings, the sexual humiliation, all of this, the sleep deprivation, the dogs, the whole business. And that's all torture as well. And of course, it's an outrage. Here you have the President of the United States admitting to torture, and nothing, absolutely nothing has happened. Which brings me to an interesting subject. You know, when I was in Europe, I was just there for a week at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, where I'm the head of the board of that organization, and it's somewhat similar to the Center for Constitutional Rights, and it does cases around Europe. But I got a sense there, because we had a large meeting with a number of the people who are doing accountability cases around the United States in Europe. There's worries for these officials of the United States or former officials. It's really going to be to go to Europe. Someone asked me about, what do you think, as you did, about Bush's comment, "Damn it, I waterboarded," essentially. I told him, go ahead. I said, well, one of the things Bush should not do is visit the Prado very soon. Of course, that's the major museum in Madrid, because there's two cases going on in Madrid that I met with the lawyers when I was there. Where some of the center is also the lawyers in those cases. One is called the Bush Six, which is around the lawyers, the six lawyers who were involved in writing these torture memos. And the other is an open investigation of what happened in Guantanamo. And those cases are proceeding. Those are the ones that the famous Judge Garzon was on for a while, but has now been removed and is being investigated or indicted, actually, or maybe even tried for some ridiculousness about the Spanish Civil War and opening the graves. But we won't have to go there. But it just should be understood that in Spain there are serious criminal investigations going on. And that's not all. I met the lawyer that we work with in Belgium, and he is filing a case on behalf of a Guantanamo detainee who was recently sent to Belgium against U.S. officials. Then in Germany itself, where the headquarters of the European Center is, there's a case in which the criminal court said they pinned down the 13 CIA agents who were involved in the kidnapping of a German citizen named El Masri. And he was sent eventually out of Macedonia into Afghanistan and was tortured. Now, so far, the German government hasn't yet asked for the extradition of those CIA agents, and perhaps they never will. But right now, there's indictments, or at least criminal complaints, against 13 CIA agents in Germany. So you have Spain against torture in the United States. You have Belgium is going to have that case. Germany, Italy, 26 CIA agents have been indicted and actually sentenced to jail. But, of course, Italy has not asked for their extradition yet, but they're sitting there. So you have a fair amount going on in Europe. And also while I was in Germany, I met lawyers who were working on a case in Poland. There was a U.S. secret site in Poland where they took people to be tortured, conceivably even Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a so-called claimed mastermind of 9/11. And he was waterboarded in Poland. And now there's an investigation going on in Poland, primarily of the Polish cooperation, not yet linking to the U.S., but the Polish cooperation with the U.S. in setting up that site. And there's a similar secret site was set up in where? Lithuania. Likewise, there's an investigation going on there. So Europe, and I think that's the key to this, as the British have settled, we're going to see more and more of this going on in all of Europe. And it's like those pop-ups where you slam them down with a hammer and another one keeps coming up. They're not going to be able to keep this down. Michael, as I said, I went through security when I came back and forth from Europe this last trip. But I don't think I went through that high security, at least not the one that they're more than contemplating, starting to use. It's some kind of a body scanner. And there was a recent piece by a guy named John Tyner who was subjected to one of these so-called body scanners. What is a body scanner?
Something that uses radiation that can penetrate into your clothes and right down to your skin and then actually a little bit of your skin, too. So you get the person's whole body outline. You can see everything. I've seen photos of this, and when I say everything, I mean genitals, everything. So they give you a choice, the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. Here's your choice. You can either go through this porno machine.
And this porno machine is also, before you get to the choice, is done by X-ray, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it has a potential danger because how much X-ray can we take?
Yeah, especially if you're a pregnant woman.
It's a choice.
So it's not a good thing.
Right.
Congress was against this thing, and so the government went around Congress, and they got some special funding for $25 million to buy these machines, and they're starting to install them now in the airports. So you got a choice. You go through the airport, they can either look at you naked, or you can get an aggressive pat-down, which includes genital pat-down. My hero of the day, I nominate John Tyner. He took the option of getting the pat-down. They started patting him down, and he says to him, "Don't touch my junk." He wouldn't let them touch him where they wanted to touch him. So they're looking to prosecute the guy.
Really? I didn't realize that. I read the article. I didn't even get that.
They can fine him up to $11,000, and he's fighting them. And he makes the point that this is what he calls fear theater. We're not any safer because they can look at your genitals in a machine. This isn't going to stop terrorism. It hasn't, and it won't. But it keeps the idea up in the mind of the American public that something terrible and scary is out there, and it keeps the thing rolling.
Let me see if I understand this. These machines are going to be installed in all the airports, international airports for sure.
Yeah. And they've installed $25 million worth already, but this is our future. If you don't like it, they're going to pat you down aggressively.
Oh, and by the way, Michael, one interesting fact about these full-body scanners is who's promoting them. Michael Chertoff, who is the head of Homeland Security, he now has a consulting agency called the Chertoff Group, and he's been promoting these full-body scanners as a security measure for the United States. And, of course, guess who Michael Chertoff, former Homeland Security Secretary, represents in his organization? His security consulting group includes a client that manufactures the full body scanning machines. So there you go, it. The revolving door from being bad in government to being bad in business. Thank you, Michael Chertoff, for full body scanners. One of the cases in Vienna that the European Center has been working on is a case involving the head of Chechnya, a man named Kadyrov. The lawyer I work with in Berlin, Wolfgang Kolick, represented a young man, 27 years old, last year or 2 years ago, in Vienna, who was bringing a criminal case against the president of Chechnya. This man had been Kadyrov's bodyguard and was tortured directly, he says, by Kadyrov, who was personally involved in his torture. And he flees to Vienna, and he begins a criminal case, or the beginnings of a criminal case, in which he was going to be the key witness against the president of Chechnya. And he gets murdered on the streets in Vienna, just shot down. Apparently, this is not, well, it's unusual, obviously, anywhere, but not completely unusual. So Kadyrov is murdered. That's actually the client of Wolfgang Kolick and the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. So this week, while I was in Berlin, Wolfgang was heading over to Vienna along with another lawyer from ECCHR, that's the European Center, because now they have found three of the murderers who actually shot the guy down. And they're trying those three for murder right on the streets of Vienna. They have not yet indicted Kadyrov. They don't necessarily think they have enough information to prove it. But in Europe, it's interesting. The trial of criminal defendants, the victim also has a lawyer in the trial. So there's a lawyer in Vienna in the trial on behalf of the victim, who is this 27-year-old Umar Israelov from Chechnya. That's the man who was murdered. So he has a lawyer there. Wolfgang was there to also represent him, and we have a lawyer there from the European Center. So right now, that murder trial against the three is going on, and the lawyer for Israelov, the man who was murdered, opened by saying this case leads straight to Kadyrov in Chechnya. Now, she takes a high risk. I have to tell you, this is very scary stuff, what's going on in Vienna or what's going on with Chechnya and Kadyrov altogether. So it's really interesting that this could happen in the middle of Europe.
Lawyers getting bumped off and witnesses getting bumped off, we read about in Latin America, but spreading to Europe, it really is something.
One thing I saw, and I can just end on this, the UN rapporteur, and that's just a fancy word for UN specialist, United Nations specialist, just finished his six-year job with the United Nations, Manfred Novak, who also happens to be from Vienna. Manfred Novak is on the board that I am in Berlin, and he gave us a Saturday evening presentation on torture. He was the special rapporteur on torture. And you walked away from it saying, is the world just completely hopeless? He visited 18 separate countries. Of the 18 countries, he took a representative sample, Middle East, South American, Asian, North American. And he came away having the photographs of 17 of the 18 countries engaged deeply in torture and doing nothing about it. And I mean routine police station torture. And of course, we've covered that on this show, the police station torture in Chicago, which our colleagues have done such a good job, including your nephew, of exposing. So that was a pretty depressing lecture, actually, because you realize we have a world that's filled with torture. And he concluded, and I'll conclude this by saying, the role of the United States and Europe in torture has made his work and the ability to stop torture almost impossible. Because now if he goes to some like two-bit dictatorship, he goes to them to say, well, you guys have to stop torture. The people look at him like he's out of his mind. He says, your countries, your Western countries, the United States, is engaged in torture. Who are you to lecture us about torture? So that's where we'll leave that for today.
Today we look at a victory for workers of the Campaign for Justice at Flaum Appetizing Corporation. Immigrants from Mexico and Ecuador challenged sweatshops conditions at a New York City processor and distributor of kosher foods. The workers used innovative legal advocacy and organizing tools to win justice at the company. The company, Flaum Appetizing, illegally withheld hundreds of thousands of dollars in compensation owed to the workers and used anti-immigrant retaliation when workers stood up for their rights. To tell us more about the details of the victory, we welcome attorney Daniel Gross. Gross is co-founder and executive director of Brand Workers International, a nonprofit organization protecting and advancing the rights of retail and food employees. He's also a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome, Dan, to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here, Heidi.
We're fresh from that great celebration of Brand Workers victory a couple of weeks ago, and now you've had another victory. Tell us about the Flaum Appetizing Corporation.
Flaum is a top processor and distributor of kosher food products. They sell to many of New York supermarkets, both kosher and standard markets. They sell Flaum hummus. They sell hummus under the Sonny and Joe's brand, and they're the exclusive distributor in New York of the Tanuva dairy products and Bodek cut vegetables. Unfortunately for the immigrant workers who are employed at Flaum, the company for years has unlawfully withheld overtime, has discriminated against immigrants, have employed abusive managers, and finally the workers just had enough. They courageously stood up for their rights. They demanded to be paid according to the law. And in response to their protected activity, Flaum and its owner, Moish Gredhut, has embarked on a relentless campaign of retaliation, firing 17 of the workers en masse, throwing them onto the street, putting them at risk of eviction, not being able to put food on the table and get the utility bills paid. Thankfully, the workers, far from taking it lying down, are engaged in a very hard-hitting campaign on the streets of New York, on fantastic media outlets like Law & Disorder, get the word out and put pressure on this company to do the right thing and comport itself with the law. What the company has done in retaliation in the legal arena is they're resisting a February 2009 court opinion dealing with the retaliation the workers faced when they were fired. The company owes over $260,000 in this labor board case after a full trial. The employer had the chance to make their case, call their witnesses. They lost. That order has been enforced, but Flaum is still resisting, and they're resisting for one reason, immigration. We've had members there at Flaum for 13, 11, 9 years, no question of where they were born, where they were from. The only question was, did they work hard for 60, 70, 80 hours a week to enrich this company? Now, when they finally come together, say no to the abuse, say no to a general manager, Aviram Chen, that calls Latino workers cockroaches, saying no to wage theft, the boss brings up the question of immigration. It's despicable. We need to put all our energy and all our heart in opposing this kind of discrimination, and we are. We're educating customers, amongst other tactics, in front of supermarkets where Flaum is sold.
And how many, Daniel, in New York City are we talking about?
Between, I'd say, about 24 supermarkets. Our focus right now is on a supermarket in Borough Park, Brooklyn, called KRM Kuehl. And Kairam Co. is a huge seller of Flam products, their hummus, their pickle, their Middle Eastern salad. And Kairam Co., instead of engaging in some kind of productive dialogue, instead of accepting any accountability for profiting off a product which uses labor which is best characterized as sweatshop labor, Kairam Co. cooperated with Flam to drag us into the legal process, filed a bullying legal action, Flam did, to try to silence workers' voices and stop these peaceful, dignified protests in front of the supermarkets. They're based on the conditions under which these products are made.
So you're being sued as bullies. Who's representing you?
We actually recently prevailed. There's two components to the campaign. There's the Industrial Workers of the World Labor Union. They're represented by Eisner and Meyer, the great Jeannie Meyer and Gene Eisner, and young law clerk working with them, Benjamin Dichter. Brand workers represented ourselves, and we're very pleased to report that we stared down their Taft-Hartley charges at the board and stood strong, as we said we would, and recently got word that, faced with the prospect of their charge being dismissed, the employer backed down and withdrew their anti-free speech charge.
Now, what's going to happen, though, with the enforcement component of that earlier court case you mentioned?
There's a lot coming up, and I want to speak to that. Really important actions in support of the farm workers. They will not be bullied. They will see this through to the end. In addition to the large amount of money they're owed for retaliation, they're owed hundreds of thousands of dollars more in a pending federal court trial, which the employer is also resisting very fervently. Last week, on Thursday, there was a powerful action in support of the National Day Against Wage Theft. Brand workers, along with the Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York and other organizations, are rising up both against the Farm Appetizing Corporation and Mario Batali's Del Posto restaurant, which is the subject of a campaign by restaurant workers that are part of Rock New York. We're going to be spreading the message that both Mr. Batali and Mr. Grudhut, the owner of Flam, have engaged in wage theft, are wage theft criminals, and need to be held accountable.
We talked about Flam, but you know, we've had you on the show before, and we've talked about brand workers. Can you give us some sense of who brand workers are, what it's about, what kind of work you're doing?
Brand workers is operating a joint campaign called Focus on the Food Chain. Much of the food that we consume in New York markets and restaurants is distributed by a corridor of sweatshops that line southern Queens and northern Brooklyn, where recent immigrants are employed. Overtime is hardly ever paid. Minimum wage is often violated. No retirement benefits, no health care, extreme discrimination, extreme abuse, extremely heavy work without appropriate health and safety standards. Very, very brutal conditions. Thankfully, Brand Workers has been able to connect with some workers in the industry leaders who are engaging in organizing drives to hold these sweatshops accountable and ultimately overcome these sweatshop conditions. So the campaigns use litigation, use direct action, and use organizing to really put some pressure on these very bad actor type employers in the sweatshop industry. We were very pleased to wage an extremely hard-hitting campaign against Wild Edibles, a prominent distributor and processor of seafood in New York City, supplier to some very famous restaurants. The workers waged a two-and-a-half-year campaign through which they were able to persuade 75 of New York's most prominent restaurants to stop serving seafood, oysters, tuna, salmon from Wild Edibles until the workers' rights ultimately were vindicated. So we're very pleased to be expanding Focus on the Food Chain. We're campaigning against Flam. We're campaigning against other similar sweatshops. And we're reaching out to workers in the sector who are experiencing extremely difficult conditions, but at the same time are ready to fight back, are ready to lead their own campaigns to challenge and ultimately overcome these sweatshop conditions.
Dan, I just want to go back to the hundreds of thousands that the court found Flam owed. How is that money going to be paid?
That's a date that is important. I want to emphasize the date is December 8th at the Labor Board in Brooklyn, 2 Metro Tech Center in downtown Brooklyn. The board will be bringing Flam back in front of a judge to win compliance with this order. Again, the workers prevailed on claims regarding this tremendous amount of retaliation, 17 workers thrown on the street en masse. The workers prevail in February 2009, They haven't seen a dime of that $260,000+ for one reason and one reason alone. The boss has one argument, and it deals with immigration. And that is what will be contested by the labor board and the workers' attorneys on December 8th at 2 Metro Tech Center, which is the NLRB in Brooklyn. We're asking people to come out, join the workers, pack the court to demonstrate to FLAUM and its owner, Moish Grudhut, that tolerates anti-immigrant discrimination. We're not going to stand for it. The workers won't back down. Despite all the threats and retaliation, the workers' determination is very strong, and they will see this through until victory is won.
Daniel Gross from Brand Workers, you have our solidarity. Is there a website you want to share with our audience?
Absolutely. I encourage folks to visit brandworkers.org. I'll repeat, brandworkers.org. Please also connect with the Focus on the Food Chain campaign on Facebook. Just type in Focus on the Food Chain, and you'll find our campaign on Facebook. It's a great way to plug in. There's 3 actions per week, every week, in addition to larger actions several times a month, and we're more than happy to have people participate. The workers are leading the fight, but they have asked for support from the community, and there's a tremendous amount to do to be helpful and make sure that we win, and we win decisively.
Well, Attorney Daniel Gross from Brand Workers, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
It's been great talking.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye,
Your
Dan.
Work has been amazing.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
It's been almost a year since Haiti's catastrophic earthquake took the lives of nearly 200,000 people, leaving 1.5 million homeless. Now, women and girls in the camps have lived in fear of the constant threat of rape and violence. Groups of attorneys and advocates for displaced women in Haiti are calling for urgent action to confront an epidemic of sexual violence in the camps. On-the-ground investigations have revealed a pattern of rape, beatings, and threats against the lives of Haitian women. A petition submitted by the groups to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights calls for the IACHR to require the Haitian government to take action, such as installing lighting in the camps and providing housing. Joining us today is Bill Quigley, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is an aspect of the aftermath of Haiti that not many of us have heard about, or it certainly hasn't received much attention, and that's the conditions under which women and girls are living in the camps. Can you briefly give us an overview?
Yes. I was in Haiti not too long ago and visited a number of the camps with some grassroots women's organizations there. People really, even myself, I've been to Haiti, 20-something times, but I really was shocked by how terrible things were there. There's still over 1 million people that are homeless, and most people are living in, we call them camps, but they really are not camps. They're really just collections of people living in parks, some people pitching tents or making shelters on the street, literally in the middle of the street, in many cases right up to the edge of the street. But every park, every schoolyard, every backyard, every churchyard has people living in them. And maybe half of the 1 million people actually are in a tent. And some of them are as little as pup tents, you know, those things that are like 2.5 feet off the ground where you can't even stand up in. But a lot of people are in just shelters of wood pounded into the ground with some sort of tarp on the top and tarps on the side. They have called them camps, and they say that they have over 1,300 of these camps.
How many people altogether you think in the camps?
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands, maybe as many as a million people, but nobody really knows. Of these 1,300-plus camps that they've identified, there are, you know, less than 100 who actually are camps that are run by somebody. These are just camps where people have gathered. And as a result, none of these camps have running water. None of them have electricity. None of them have sanitation or anything like that. Very few of them even have any sort of food availability to people. We went to a couple, and they had right in downtown Port-au-Prince, right, you know, people are familiar with the picture of the palace that had pancaked after this. Well, surrounding the palace, all kinds of parks, big, you know, open parks, not green parks, but more concrete parks. Those are all filled with people now. Tens of thousands of people live in there. And women and children, as in everything, are much more vulnerable when chaos hits. And it's exacerbated by people living in these camps. And the women that we met with told us, you know, they don't have food. There is some medical care there for emergency type, you know, some volunteer medical folks that are in this neighborhood. But like the entire neighborhood, which is maybe 20, 30,000 people, is served by one source of water, which is they drive a truck up to this place and they fill the tanks up with water twice a day. So there's like four or five spigots. And so tens of thousands of people line up in the morning and then in the afternoon just to get water. And to go to the bathroom, they have like about 30 plastic portalettes that are right along the street there. And the women say, you know, it gets dark. They don't have electricity. If you go to the bathroom at night, that you run a real risk of being assaulted, raped, kidnapped, and the like. And so kids aren't allowed to go to the bathroom, that sort of stuff. And so there is a real, real human rights dimension in disaster, as we all know. But one of the leading edge of things is that in every disaster, it's women and children who suffer the most. Specifically, CUNY Law School, MADRE, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, the Port-au-Prince office of Mario Joseph, and CCR got together and have asked the Inter-American Court for Human Rights to do some special precautionary measures for women and girls, particularly in Port-au-Prince. And the very, very simple things, asking for lighting at night in the camps, asking for some security. People are they don't want the UN to be the security down there. By and large, you know, for those of us in the North who aren't really that understanding of this, think of the UN as sort of the peace guys. Well, they're thought more really as an occupying army in Port-au-Prince by most people because they're preserving the order, but the order is that 90% of the people are disenfranchised. So they don't really want more UN presence. They don't really want more Haitian National Police presence because those folks are pretty rough folks. So they're asking for assistance in being able to do some community monitoring where women, older people in the camps might have access to phones, flashlights, and some sort of communication system so that they can take care and self-patrol. They do that now in most places, but they are at a tremendous disadvantage if you know, there's thousands of people and something happens on one edge. You literally, these little shelters are within inches of each other, and the space between them, you know, is in the great places might be 3-4 feet. In the worst places, maybe a foot is like the pathway. So if somebody's in trouble, you know, 100 yards away, you literally can't get to them. And so the people paying the highest price are women and girls. And so there's a big human rights dimension to that, the violence that's been, you know, that they're suffering.
Is there any kind of self-organization among the women in terms of forming patrols and sort of standing up to acts of aggression?
Yes, there is, and people are doing that. In some cases, the men are doing that as well. But the problem is that everybody is trying to leave these camps. And what people have is they leave a camp that has had a lot of attacks. People just leave and they go to another camp to try and stay there. So it's very fluid in terms of people there, and people are not trying to make long-term plans because they hope they're not going to be there. But, yeah, there is self-patrol in that, but somebody with a gun or somebody with a machete is incredibly empowered in a place that, you know, your only protection is a plastic sheet. Don't have doors, don't have locks, don't have even the basic things that you could expect for security. So the other thing is, you know, there's no mental health treatment. The prisons are, and the whole, you know, criminal justice system, which was bad before, is the worst now. So in terms of a few people can terrorize thousands and thousands of folks.
And to add to this, we have the cholera outbreak.
Yes, which is something that people have sort of been expecting to happen for a while. And if you saw the way people live and walk through there and talk to people, it is as bad as anything you've ever seen any place in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, 2 hours from Florida. And a lot of our sisters and brothers that we have, you know, have family in the United States and that sort of stuff. But it's just a complete failure of the United Nations, of the United States. Haiti itself is, you know, the government is in complete failure as well. It's like an entire country's had what we used to call, you know, nervous breakdown or psychotic. It was just total breakdown. As I said, people don't have food. They don't have, you know, don't really have access to water. And every single day is survival day.
We're speaking with Attorney Bill Quigley, who's the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill, the United States made all kinds of promises after the disaster. What's been the follow-up on those offers?
Well, there's a couple of things that people should really know about that. One is that, you know, the United States, the first response was we're going to put up $100 million. And like that was the same day that I think a family in Kentucky won the Powerball for about $130 million. So the initial response was very little. And as it kept growing, it grew to where the United States had pledged $1 billion to take care of people and humanitarian issues, and then another $1 billion to rebuild Haiti. That $1 billion, I think, is mostly used up, but people don't understand that somewhere between a third and 40% of that money is reimbursement to the military for our military contributions to the people of Haiti. And in terms of actual money that's going out to the Haitian government, that is just a few cents on the dollar. Most of it's going to NGOs. And, you know, the NGOs play as important a role in Haiti as they do any place in the world. But in terms of the $1 billion that we promised to rebuild Haiti, as of very, very recently, as you know, the end of October, none of that money, not a dime of that money, has been spent in Haiti. And as a result, the Associated Press reports that of the rubble and all, you know, all the buildings that fell in that, only 2% of that has actually been removed. I had gone to Haiti 2 weeks after the earthquake, slept in the yard of a place where I had been many times, was there, and the place was just ruined. And when I went back in October, but for the tents and all that stuff, it could have happened last week. I mean, there's not just several story high piles of rubble. There's still buildings that look like, you know, they're 30 seconds away from falling in. The streets have been mostly cleared so that, you know, cars can drive down, people can walk them. But I said something about this at one event, and somebody afterwards said that another person had said, well, you know, the Haitians should do a little self-help, pick some of this stuff up. But this takes heavy-duty equipment. This is not the kind of thing that people could just go grab a concrete rebarred wall and walk off with it. People have combed through them to try to pull people out. They've tried to save whatever, you know, pictures and valuables they can. But these are mountains of concrete that are all over the place, and just a little bit has been cleaned up in the very deep now, downtown.
Now, Michael asked you about the U.S., but what about there was a big U.N. effort that was led by Bill Clinton to raise not just the U.S. part of it, but from international donors.
Right. I think the report on that is that about 15% of that money that was pledged has actually arrived. You know, the thing happened in January, so almost going on 9, 10, 12 months later, 15% of that money has arrived. So people talk big and that. And, you know, Haiti has benefited from thousands of volunteers, and people have come and people have really helped. But Paul Farmer has indicated, and other people that have long-term relationships with the place, you can't take care of of a country or a region as a disaster just by volunteers. I'm a survivor of Katrina, lived there for many years. And as much as we depended on the kindness of strangers, as the old Southern thing goes, you know, if volunteers can't rebuild hospitals, volunteers can't rebuild the Institute of Justice or the legal system and those sort of things. There are some fundamental things that have to be done by government. And so in terms of assisting the Haitian government, it's a lot of criticism of them, much of it justified, that they're unresponsive, corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. But we being the international community, we have to be with the people of Haiti to rebuild those institutions that help run a country of 9-10 million people.
What you did here, the center, along with the other human rights groups you mentioned, filed a, quote, legal action in front of the Inter-American Commission. What do you expect to get from that? Why did you do that?
Well,
and what's it about?
Yeah, it is the first one that we filed was specifically about gender violence against women and girls. And we talked about the international human rights that people have to be protected, to sanctity of life and protection of body and health and those sort of things, safety. We specifically included not just Haiti in this, but the international community. And
you mean as defendants or what?
Yes.
Yes. So you have the Haitian government, but
we also have asked the International Commission to hold the UN and the international community accountable for the way that aid is being spent, that is not prioritizing the safety and security of women and girls. We included in that just dozens of reports of women being kidnapped, people starving to death and having to sell themselves in order to be able to survive, others being attacked after dark, other people being attacked in daytime and asking for intervention by the police, and that stuff hasn't worked. The police, asking for money to be able to investigate, saying that they need money for their cars and that sort of stuff. But again, not focusing it so much on just the Haitians, because that country has collapsed, but focusing on the international community and the NGOs who are receiving this international money to be up and running there, that they have a role to play in all this as well. Most people have seen, Sean Penn, that he runs a little camp and that stuff. And, there are a couple of camps, not a little camp, maybe 20,000 people. But you're talking about out of a million, that's not a really big, it's not a big part of it. And so maybe the Red Cross runs a couple of, but most of these camps are just totally, something like 80% of them are just run by whoever's there. And it's just up to them to create their own government, their own protection, their own water distribution, their own way of dealing with medical issues and all that. And it's inhuman, and it's so unjust. And so the complaint with the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights is to ask them to hold an immediate hearing on this, for them to get out of the various country capitals and the Washington, D.C. office and go to Haiti, go on the ground, walk these places, talk to these folks. And as your listeners and you all know, there's just no experience that can duplicate being on the ground in these situations and talking and listening to people and having the people give their own stuff. We're working in this with five grassroots Haitian women's organizations. And when you talk about grassroots organizations in Haiti, these often, they don't even have grass. They don't have a website. They don't have an office. They don't have a phone. They don't have a budget. These are just people that are getting together that are working for justice and trying to accompany women who have been hurt, accompany them to make sure that they get some medical treatment, then accompanying women to go talk with the police to try to get some action about it, working with the people who are in these hundreds of camps to try to set up their own security system. But we were in one, for example, one camp that was maybe, I don't know, they said 5,000 people, and it was on a school grounds, and school has restarted. And so the school that's there, they'd like everybody to leave because they don't have a place for the kids to run or play or anything. This was like the playground and the soccer field or whatever like that. And, they'd like to do something else, but there's no place to go. The international effort has created about, I think they said, 13,000 temporary shelters for 13,000 families. These are not 13,000 out of a million homeless is just nothing. And this camp, they had really come together and they had worked and they were trying to take care of each other and they'd had some attacks and they have patrols. Young men do that. But literally 5 feet away is another camp. And that camp hasn't really gotten it together. And so the people in that camp are coming over to this camp trying to ask them to help them, and they can barely take care of the couple hundred families that they have in their place. It's chaos and horror on a scale. It's just, even for those of us who pay attention to these things, unimaginable.
Bill, is anything functioning down there? Is there any positive effort?
The positive things really are just these grassroots organizations who are not funded by and large, not supported, and they're just doing it themselves. And the hope and the inspiration that I see there is the Haitian people themselves, that despite having living a life that I'm not sure I could live for a month, maybe less than a month, with, you know, having to figure out where I'm going to get food every day, not having access to water, toilet facility that's used by thousands of other people that's, you know, it's far away to get to, you had no place to take a bath, no privacy and stuff like that. I'm just not really sure that I could live. But people are living, and people are praying. They are banding together to protect themselves. In many cases, it's not as big as a camp. It may be, you know, just a couple of families who just say, we'll try to take care of our couple of families. So there's like three or four families that are looking out for each other and sharing food and that sort of stuff. But they are still trying, and they are still – there's been a couple of things where they had a sit-in at the UN, and they've done some other stuff. But by and large, they don't think that the international community is going to help them, because, you know, if they were going to help them, they would have already helped them, and they're just trying to figure out what they can do on their own. So that's the hopeful thing. In terms of what the UN – the UN, you know, as much as I love and admire their work and stuff like that, they hold these meetings on, like, women's security. They'll hold them out by the airport because that's where the UN offices are. But the meetings aren't even in Creole. They're not even in French. They're usually in English because that's the NGOs that are there. So women who show up, they can't, and nobody even tells them what's going on. If they bring their own interpreter, then they can have somebody tell them what's going on, and then they can try to make some response to that. But it's a real horrific situation, violation of lots and lots of things. And it's really very close, and as most of the listeners know, the world has moved on. You know, there have been other disasters in other places, the miners and the floods in Asia and those sorts of things, but...
Bill, it's actually really a searing story to hear. I recall the time I was in Haiti after the first restoration of President Aristide, and there were UN NGOs everywhere. And you go up to Paytonville, there were just lines of jeeps with the word UN on the side or other NGOs. And you said to yourself, what good is this really doing? What's it doing for people? It just looks like it's a feeding trough a little bit for NGOs to be there and eat in good restaurants and have these jeeps. I mean, that's some of the reaction I'm getting from...
Right. And I think people identify there's three sources of power in Haiti. It's the Haitian government. There's the USUN, which they sort of see as the same thing since the U.S. really does that. And then the third is the NGO community, because there are thousands of NGOs. And it is a standing joke that the nicest cars and nicest trucks on the road are all NGOs. There's no doubt about that. Or they're, you know, police or government. That's who they are. You depend even on the people you don't respect. You know, you have to be nice to the government because of what little you can get from the government. You have to be nice to the U.S. despite this stuff. And you have to be sort of nice to these NGOs, because to get a job as a part-time translator or a part-time driver or something like that can make the difference of survival or not for a family. So it's a difficult relationship for people. And the NGOs, the big problem with NGOs and all, you know, most of us work for NGOs in the United States and stuff, but is that they are accountable to themselves. And they're usually not accountable to the communities that they serve. And it's never more true than there, where, you know, people just fly in, spend some time, fly out. I do that myself. Questions about allocation of resources, is that the best way to do it? How are we accountable to the community? How do we support the rebuilding of a public infrastructure, which people really need? It's one thing to say it's corrupt and it doesn't perform, and so therefore we have to run our own little clinic. That's fine. Just run your own little clinic and not take any responsibility for helping to build up the public health care system is irresponsible and helps create and energize the bad things that are happening. So to undercut the public sector.
If people want to find out more, where do they go? What do they do? Are there sites they can visit?
Yeah, I think the place for those of us in the United States, the place to start is this Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. It's IJDH. And they are the partners with the on-the-grounds folks in Port-au-Prince. Those are our partners at CCR. That's who we look to for, you know, helping us figure out what's going on, because they have a long-term relationship there with people in Haiti. So I think it's something like www.ijdh.org. And they have ways that people, they try to activate people in the United States on U.S. issues. You know, the U.S. hasn't come through with the money that that we've promised. And so there's some ways that people can try to impact the United States government to live up to its commitments. Problem with that is, I mean, there's a substantive problem with that. The U.S. is interested in funding U.S. actors in Haiti. You know, so a lot of that money is going to go there. And truthfully, the $1 billion or something like that, the sense of Congress in that is they're going to give that to Bill Clinton to really decide, his NGO to decide how it's best spent, because there's such suspicion that it'd be wasted by the government. As, and was said earlier, of the money that's actually come, you know, like 5 cents out of every dollar actually goes to the Haitian government to do it. It goes either to NGOs or reimbursement for our military. So some real problems with that, too, to have Bill Clinton, for all practical purposes, the head of Haiti at this point. He has more power than anybody else in Haiti. He has these sitting on this money. I don't want to say they're not doing anything, because they are doing some things, but they are, most of the people in Haiti never seen him, never seen any impact from anything that that group has done. You know, the whole system's really tragically skewed away from accountability to people, accountability to democracy, and the kinds of participation and transparency that we would expect. But there's a lot of things that people can do. But I would start with this Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. If you go on the CCR website, probably have a copy of our petition to the Inter-American Court, which tells a lot of these stories of individuals. We got their names blacked out, but it tell you the specifics of how people are living. We're in the process of doing another one to try and stop the forced evictions that have already started of people in Haiti, where private landowners or churches or schools or things like that are just bringing in 20, 30 police officers and just forcing people to leave. There's no place for people to go, clearly. They just end up going to another camp or something like that. They don't want people to make the camps permanent, but they don't have an alternative at this time either. I've spent too much of my life trying to fight for people's right to stay in crappy housing, but bad housing is better than no housing. And so that's some of the fights that are going on there, and there'd be more details there at CCR and the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's really remarkable work, and really appreciate it.
Sobering report. Thank you, Bill.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Okay.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.